Welcome today to our interview series with outstanding professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Marcus Jacobson, top international security authority, principal scientist at PARC, past principal research scientist at RSA Security. Marcus, thank you for coming in today to share your deep insights with the audience.
No problem. You're very welcome, and I'm happy to be here.
Marcus, as a principal scientist at Palo Alto Research Center, what does your work entail?
It's hard to say because it's pretty much up to me, which is a wonderful thing, and it's also pretty scary because I have to come up with ideas of how to guide others and to guide the research here. I'm in charge of trying to figure out trends and to understand fraud online and to develop countermeasures. It's a very exciting task.
What was the catalyst for the security startup Ravenwhite?
My old colleague Ari Jules and I, we had lots of idea about things that we felt were very different from how people did it currently. We were frustrated that to not see any progress in the company we were both working before. People did it the traditional way, and we wanted to see change. We wanted our ideas to be expressed. We had a very different type of approach than the typical industry approach, and that is what we wanted to give air to.
What is the impetus behind security cartoon?
The question in security often comes down to what will the user do? If the end user will neglect to take the sufficient actions and will perhaps even do things that are bad to his own security, then you're in a very poor and weak position as a security provider. So you have to develop a minimal understanding of what is good and what is bad among users. Now, you can't put a textbook in front of people and say, you've got to become a security professional and good luck reading this book. But you've got to make it easy and enjoyable to take part in the education and understand very critical and often rather complex elements, like what should a URL look like? It's not an easy thing to tell people who don't necessarily care about, you know, the internet and internet security. They only want to perform their transactions on Amazon, say.
You know, getting back to your security startup, Ravenwhite, do you have any security lessons to share from that work?
I guess the most important insight is that most people do things the old-fashioned way. For example, in the context of click fraud, a very common approach is to filter out the bad stuff, to somehow identify what is bad and to remove that, not count it as a click. And people aren't willing to think of the opposite approach, which in our case and in this particular case is to say, let's count the good stuff instead. Can we identify what is certainly good and somehow pay extra for that, and then all the others we would give a discount for? And to take such a radical change in the basic structure allows a lot of novel things to come out. And that is has been our mantra pretty much, that let's not think of what people are doing. Let's absolutely ignore the status quo, but let's instead just solve the problem. And that is often proving to be very helpful.
Marcus, I've got a fairly lengthy question here, so I'm going to break it into parts. What I'd like to do is get your views on or get your insights on little known but essential security tips from each of these topic areas. So let's first start off with authentication.
Well, there are many kinds of authentication, of course. There's authentication of a person to a computer to a computer, and various types of these as well. I'm going to focus about from a person to a computer. And what we normally do is we type our passwords. But there's a very common problem here that people don't think of very much, and that is, what if you don't remember your password? And as there are more and more websites out there, and you have to use more and more passwords, you've got two choices. Either you use many more passwords, and you'll forget more, or you use the same password over and over, and that really is not a very good thing, because it's sufficient that you lose it once on one site, whether it's a bad site or it's hacked or whatever, and then you're in trouble. And so the question is, how can you deal with this situation in a way that you don't put the user at risk for forgetting their password. Very common approach is to ask questions like, what are the last four digits of your social security number? What is the street you grew up on? You know, these standard challenge questions, and they're so easy to data mine. And so a good security lesson here is that you have to avoid things that can be data mined. Instead of asking for things that exist in various files with the government or with private institutions or maybe even on Facebook, you should ask people what they prefer and what they not prefer. And even though they might express some of their preferences on their blogs, they're never going to express a full profile of the sort that we have in mind. And when you do that, you don't face a risk that an attacker out there will be able to data mine everything about you and then process you. So for authentication, that would be my principal guidance to avoid data mining problems.
Okay, let's go to the next topic area in terms of little known but essential security tips, this time with phishing and countermeasures.
Well, I have a favorite example here. Many banks, when they send you email, in order for you to know that it's them, they do what's called mutual authentication. Before you authenticate to them and say your PIN or your password, they try to prove to you that they are who they claim to be. And the way they do it is that they say the last four digits of your account number, whether it's a credit card number or your bank account number is, and then they give you the number. Say they would say the last four digits of your credit card number is 4640. Now, the little known fact here is that people don't understand the credit card formats. So if people receive an email that says, instead of here are your last four digits, it says here are your first four digits, and we performed a lot of experiments to confirm this, then people think that is also right. So they might look at their credit card and they say, yes, that's true. These are the first four digits. Now the problem here is that that's the issuer code. That's absolutely predictable to an attacker who could just say, okay, this person, we have reason to believe that they're with, say, Chase Bank, or they have a First USA credit card or a Bank of America credit card, and therefore they have these first four digits. They send the same to all the people that they're targeting for this particular bank, and sure enough, they will look at their card and they say, yes, that must be from my bank. So that's a horrible thing that financial institutions are doing. They're using the last four, which is reasonable, when there's no particular reason to believe that people, their users, their clients, will be able to tell that from the first four. And therefore, they're vulnerable to this really bad security risk where attackers will start using the first four and people will say, oh, it has to be for my bank. I'm going to do everything they say.
Okay, the next topic area here in terms of a little known but essential security tip would be click fraud.
Well, for click fraud, I think people don't understand exactly how they could be taken advantage of. And what I would like to the example I'd like to give here is to address the question, why me? People often think that an attacker has no reason to target me because, and then they would give a reason. For click fraud, that is just not the case. You are just kind of the launching pad for an attack. If an attacker could put malware on your computer that clicks on various things, well, that's not because you are you. It's because you have a computer. And so people don't understand that they are at risk just for existing. Now, you could also argue that they're not really at risk. They're just accomplices to the crime in a way because their computer is used. But they are at risk because the next time around when the attacker wants to do something, it might actually hurt them. It might not be a beneficial move because their machine has already been corrupted and is under the control of the attacker now.
Okay, now let's extend this talk to another topic area, and that is the human factor in security.
Well, I'd say the number one problem that security experts commit is that they think everybody thinks like them. You know, I would never fall for this, and therefore people would never fall for this. And then they start thinking technical things like, oh, this is how SSL work, and SSL works very well. You could prove it and various things. But they don't realize how vulnerable people are to just social engineering attacks. An email arrives, and it appears to come from your best friend. And it says, you know, open this. This is a hilarious little movie. Take a look at it. I know you will like it. See you later. And this is using spoofing, maybe. It's an email that appears to come from your friend, but it isn't. And the attacker knows that it's who your friend is and the email address, maybe because they scraped Facebook, where you disclosed that information, and so on. And so people will open the attachment, and immediately they will be infected. Now, the problem here is the security expert who look at this and say, you know, if my friend sends something to me, I would just ask them, what is this, before I even open it, or I would just run a scanner on it and see that there's nothing wrong. But that's not what a normal person would do. So the vulnerability of society here is that people aren't able to anticipate what regular computer users will do in a particular situation. And therefore, they will build countermeasures that are just not appropriate for society as such.
And then cryptography?
Well, my background is in cryptography. I got a PhD in cryptography. I can't say that cryptography doesn't work. It works wonderfully, but people often misunderstand what it does. For example, you hear a lot about the data is safe because it's encrypted. Or nothing can go wrong and the system is secure because the data is encrypted. What does it mean that the data is encrypted? Well, it means that if somebody gets access to that encrypted data, then they couldn't do anything with it. They can't read what it really means. But somebody has to have the key. The key has to be either stored on some machine, or it has to be memorized by a person, or some combination of these things. And that's the vulnerability, of course, that, well, at some point when the encrypted record is going to be used, the key is going to be used, and maybe that is the time at which the attacker strikes. Or maybe the attacker just ignores what the encrypted material says and just looks at who sent what to whom. And that's enough information. So there's this addiction to the notion that encryption will solve any problem, and it's just not true. Encryption is great, but it doesn't solve every security problem.
And now how about a little known but essential security tip with regards to overall network security?
Well, I think the number one thing to mention here is that people don't understand that their routers, their home routers, the access point to which they connect to the internet, is a computer. It's a computer typically running Linux, and it's a rather powerful computer, in fact. It's always connected to the internet, more or less. And what else? It doesn't have antivirus software, and many people, more than half of the people out there, do not change the password from the default password. So here you got a computer with no protection in terms of antivirus. They have often the same password that they were shipped with, which anybody could learn, and they're pretty powerful and connected to the internet. That is the kind of machine that an attacker would like to corrupt. And they could do it by just driving by, you know, a war driving attack where they replaced the firmware on the machine. They could do it in an infectious manner where your router infects your neighbor router, and then that infects your neighbor's neighbor router, and so on. Or they could do it even by a web page. You go to a bad web page, could be an advertisement that you click on, and that advertisement sends data to your computer that then makes modification without your knowledge to your router, make exposed to any kind of attack that the attacker wishes to perform. And people just don't know what a powerful machine this little router is and how well they need to protect it and how poorly they do protect it.
And then finally, in this list of topic areas where you're giving little known but essential security tips, how about protocol design?
Well, protocol design is one of those core things in terms of getting a protocol, getting things to work and to be secure. And protocol design is when you say what information is sent by whom and at what time and under what conditions. And often this is done by people who really don't have much training in the area. And I don't want to discourage people out there who feel like they want to understand security and they want to make sure that their systems are secure. But at some point, you've got to leave things to the expert. And a teeny tiny flaw in the way a protocol is designed could just absolutely destroy the security of the system. It could be as easy as how do you choose the so-called random number? if it isn't chosen very randomly, or if the seed is predictable or even constant, everything else fails. If the order of two operations is switched, well, maybe that compromises the security. At some point, you have to involve an expert, an expert to review this, or just let the expert do it in the first place. Protocol design is just too scary for average Joe who wants to improve the security of his site to get involved with.
You know, Marcus, I'm just going to go back a little bit here. You know, you have this amazing background, you know, principal scientist at Park and so forth. How did you actually get into computing? I mean, what drove your passion into computing, and how did you get your job at Park and at RSA and you know, the various roles that you've had? I mean, what kind of combination of skills and education and so forth allowed you to get these roles?
Well, I have a PhD in computer science with a focus on cryptography. What guided me to do that was mathematical inclination and a desire to either cheat or stop others from cheating. You know, that was drove me when I was a teenager. I wanted to stop people from cheating me, and I wanted instead to cheat them. You could say that I was a very, very sore loser, and I took it to the extreme. And then I brought it to research, pretty much. I tried to make it into a science. And I found that I was just very well suited for this particular line of work. And now that I'm doing fraud and anti-fraud, it's exactly the same thing. You have to think like the criminal, then you have to stop the criminal. And it all comes down to, I would say, being a sore loser.
You know, you've written some books, and you've shared some of these insights in these books. Can you share some of these key lessons from these books, such as phishing and countermeasures, or Crimeware, Understanding New Attacks and Defenses?
Both of these books, what they have in common is that they deal with fraud and very current types of attacks, and they're also trying to anticipate what's going to come next. And they're doing it based on what the entire system looks like. And we're not speaking the entire system as in all your computers, but we're saying all your computers and all your users. And so we're taking a very, very wide view of the problem. Everything that is involved in maintaining security, what is it? How does it get involved? We even look at the legal side of it. For example, legal aspects could drive trends. For example, if you think that law enforcement is getting better and better when it comes to countering phishing, what is the next logical thing for phishers to do? Well, that would be to make them less traceable. They wouldn't want to collect passwords necessarily and then use the passwords, but they would rather collect money in some other way that makes them very, very hard to trace. One way might be to infect computers of some company with malware, and it becomes a PR embarrassment for the company. The stock of the company falls, and the attacker would collect by first having bought put options in the company, which are financial instruments that increase in value when the stock of the company goes down. And then, of course, as the stock goes down, he would be able to sell with a profit, as would everybody else who thought that the stock would go down. That makes him not very traceable at all. And it's very hard for law enforcement to say that, oh, we got to nail this guy. So you could, from just an assumption that law enforcement is getting better, which it is, trace what are the likely trends. And then, once you think of those things, you got to turn around and say, okay, if this is going to be a problem to us in 2 years, how will we counter that preemptively?
Okay, Marcus, you have this incredible background. You're highly respected, international reputation as a top thought leader in this area. So I'm going to sort of pose this question to you. What do you see, based on your expertise, as some of the most important broader IT business and business challenges and solutions this year?
What I'm concerned a lot about is are things like phishing and malware. Fortunately, you see the trend of phishing going slightly down, but it's replaced a lot, with a vengeance, I would say, by malware, and a particular kind of malware attack that people call crimeware. That's malware for some kind of financial incentive. And it ties back into several things. One is spam. We have to face the problem of spam. because that is how many of these attacks are delivered. But we also have to look forward. As people use mobile devices more and more, spam is going to be replaced in significance by other things, maybe like SMS and voicemail and things like that, or just transmission of malware from machine to machine by being in proximity of each other. Another thing that is becoming increasingly important is to understand how will people react to and then various types of threats. And it's not only about threats, but their everyday life. If you're used to getting emails from your friends that says, look at this movie and this is really funny, you're conditioned to do that, even if an attacker were to pose as them and send similar things. We have to understand the social aspects of computing. People are starting to understand it, but it's just a very, very primitive research field at this point, and people know just too little. And those who understand human psychology don't necessarily understand it in the context of internet security. And this is where we need to broaden our insights and then build countermeasures that take everything into consideration.
Now, can you take this prior question and then apply it to, let's say, the next 5 years?
Well, the way I see it, crimeware could really change how people think of the internet. Right now, if you have a very low risk of being attacked when you go out there and perform transactions, whether it's to buy something or collect information or what have you, it's okay. Most people will deal with very small risks by saying it's not going to happen to me, and probably it isn't. And if it does, then they would have to figure it out. But if that risk increases, if it increases to maybe 10% of all transactions or 25% of all the transactions, then people are going to take their computing elsewhere. It's going to regress the development of the internet. Whether this is for criminal reasons, that phishers and malware writers are just becoming so good, or if it's becoming for the case for political reasons, that people are saying, well, we could use all of these computational instruments to gain political advantage. It becomes a guerrilla fight of a kind. Well, it doesn't matter. If the risk level increases to a certain level, people are just going to say, I'm not going to do it. You see it to some extent with people today that they're afraid of all the phishing emails that they're getting, and they're, as a result, saying, maybe I should not shop online. Maybe I should just go down to the mall instead. If this turns really serious, and there are indications that it could, and that would be horrible, people are just going to say, I cannot trust anything online. I cannot trust the news because they could be polluted. I can't trust the stock reports I get. And, of course, I can't trust giving my password to any site. This will regress the way we think of society. You can't book cars online. You can't book travel online. It's going to cost much more after that happens. And it's just not going to be good news to us.
You know, from your current role, what do you see as the biggest challenges in their solutions, and then how does this relate to business?
The number one problem is that the people in charge of building the countermeasures, they fix their own problems. I started working on phishing in the late 90s. I was at Bell Labs, and I spoke to people about my concern and my vision of what could happen. This was really before I knew of the word phishing. I just thought of it as online deception. And I outlined what could happen. And people said, you know, it all makes sense, but if it really does happen, if it happens at any meaningful scale, people are going to just look for that SSL lock, and they're never going to fall for it again. It's going to take one big article in the New York Times, and the whole world is going to become aware of this phishing thing, and then it's going to go away because they're going to act differently. It's not the case. It's not happening like that. People just have unreasonable expectations on the average users, and that has to stop. They might change. The people in charge of building security or deciding what products to put in place. But it doesn't change how the people out there act. In fact, people are getting more and more used to accepting anything. They accept movies, they accept certificates, they download code, they follow their friends' advice. It's increasing the risks. We have to be aware of that. We have to take everything revolving around the human into consideration. Now, I say that as a computer scientist. I'm not a social scientist. I'm trying to understand, and I'm trying to perform experiments that assess us exactly how do people react. I'm not going out and interviewing them. I am performing fake phishing attacks. They're fake only in the sense that I don't steal their credentials, but to them, it looks like I am. And then I measure the success rate, and I'm trying to understand, well, if I write the URL like this, and I write the text like this, then I get a certain yield. And if I do it like this instead, I get a different yield. And then I can draw conclusions about the psychology of the people there. You can never ask people, if you see this, would you think it's phishing? Because you alert them to the fact that maybe it is. You have to perform experiments to understand what are the true reactions of average people out there, and then that's what you have to use when you build security.
Marcus, that's really fascinating in terms of what you're seeing today. I perceive that as sort of like a gap between what's happening in security and you know, in terms of what people how they perceive it and use it. What do you see as some additional challenges in their solutions, and how does this relate to business?
One thing is that data mining is becoming increasingly used among criminals, and the reason is very simple. If I can data mine just a little bit about my potential victim or a phisher or a malware distributor, then I could increase my yield dramatically. So this corresponds to what's called spear phishing. You could call it spear malware, spear crimeware too, I guess. What I do is, if I were a phisher, I were to use context I know about you, whether I learn it from you or I place it with you, and we share some notion of what is happening, and then it's more likely that the attack is going to carry through. Now, I speak as the attacker because I think like the attacker. And what an attacker would do is they would learn a large amount of information about a large number of potential victims, and then they would post phishing emails or just email saying do this and do that in order for malware to be distributed with the context of the recipient in mind. As an analogy, imagine that somebody wants to gain access to your home. They could come and knock on the door and say, I'm from the telephone company, your phone is broken. And you'd say, I don't have any problem at all with my phone, please go away. Instead, if they were to cut the phone lines outside your house, wait for an hour, come and knock on your door, with some probability you have noticed that your phone doesn't work, you might even have reported using your cell phone. And you're overjoyed when the phone repairman comes. On the other hand, if they show up and you don't know of it yet, and you'll react exactly like the previous scenario, and the imposter there, the fraudulent person, will say instead, well, go back and look. I've just fixed it for your neighbor, and I know that you have the same problem, so I'll stay here for a minute. I'll be nice. You go back, you lift the phone, there's no signal. You're, again, overjoyed that the phone company is giving you so tremendously good service, and you let the guy in. Now, that's the analogy for spear phishing and other spear attacks. If you know a little bit about the user, about the proposed victim, you know how to get into behind whatever area they wish to secure. And it's not only about your home, it's also about your computer. That's one of the biggest threats.
And you've talked earlier before about how security practitioners think the world is logical and people do what they're told and everything is configured. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah, that's important. One of the most common misunderstandings is that people will do what they should do. For example, security practitioners, they buy a new wireless modem and they unpack it, they install it, they set their password in a very good way, and they think everybody else must do the same thing. Whereas most people will buy this router, they will unpack it, they will plug it into the wall, and they will be happy that it works. That's the difference. Similarly, security practitioners, in the context of this attack that I mentioned before, the first four digits and the last four digits, they would say, but I'm always getting the last four, and of course the first four would be tremendously dumb to react to. They don't know what the average user out there will do. So the security practitioner might say, last four, it's the way to go, because those are essentially four random digits. And that's one of the big problems. They think either that things are configured correctly, or that people will react correctly.
You know, can you talk about corrupting recommendation services and how easy it is?
Yeah, that's a good one. there is absolutely nothing stopping people from corrupting that. Look at a service like Yelp. It's a great service, and I use it a lot. But how can I trust what it says? Really, I can't. If there's, say, one particular restaurant that I'm interested in going to, how could I know that the recommendations I see there are really from people who visited the restaurant? How could I know that it's not by the owner or by the waiters or, you know, a large number of personas that are created by these? There's absolutely no reason to believe in it. The only thing I could do is to say, well, there's one cloud of people who think it's wonderful, and then there's one cloud of people who are very upset because they went there and they didn't, their expectations wasn't met. That would be one indication that there's a problem. But that is hard to do because there's always going to be some degree of disagreement with things. And so what I'm likely to do and what everybody else is likely to do is just to look at the average of something, and that is so easily manipulated. And of course, this is one of the next big frontiers as people are coming to rely much more on this. How could a service, like a restaurant, manipulate the reviews and get more business? It's trivial. Unfortunately, it's trivial. I'm not sure to what extent it's happening, but it could happen in a very, very sneaky way that would make it hard for the company providing the interface, like Yelp, to detect what a good review and a bad review is. Of course, this is a fight that they're constantly fighting to pick out the obviously bad ones. It's a review for a restaurant in Palo Alto that is submitted by somebody in Russia, and there are 2,000 other reviews submitted from the same IP address. Well, maybe that computer is not good. But attackers are going to start doing smarter things. And you could just sway the perception of services so much by this.
Marcus, you're an acknowledged world leader and thinker in this area. And so in your travels and in your work and your various roles, you must have some interesting stories that you can share with us.
Well, yes, I do. One of what I would bring up is that I worked for years on privacy. My PhD thesis was on privacy-preserving payment systems. I thought nobody would ever use a system like PayPal. PayPal was starting to get traction in the mid-90s, and I thought this is going to die because nobody could tolerate the absolute lack of privacy. That was very naive. Now I've gained a little bit of understanding that people don't care about privacy. People will, in fact, give away their privacy at an incredibly low price. And you could argue that that is their own problem. But when people don't understand, there are repercussions to their security by giving out information. That is unfortunate. And it's not only your own security, but people around you. For example, if I know your brother's mother's maiden name, I know your mother's maiden name too. So it's very clear to see that security affects people beyond themselves. So that's one thing I would say. Another kind of a funny story is, it related to my recent work on password reset technology, where we decided that we have to use preference-based questions. So it's questions that ask people about who they are and to avoid all the data mining problems. And the way we got to all of the questions we in the end used is that we actually scraped online dating sites. For a long time I was thinking, where could I have a list of questions that expresses who people are? There are two places that you really can go: online dating sites and personality tests. Personality tests often are very abstract, and that makes it hard to interpret for the user because they have to interpret it in the same way when they try to authenticate later. But dating sites have great questions, like what kind of food you like and what kind of sports do you like and what are your hobbies? And those are great starting points for an authentication system. And it's kind of a counterintuitive thing to go and scrape dating sites. And I must say that my wife thought it was a little bit funny with all of these online dating accounts of mine until I sat her down and said, look, please do not worry. I'm not dating. And in fact, I'm just doing research. And I'm sure it was just a wacko thought to many people when I presented the idea at first that this is how you get internet security solved for a large and significant problem. You start going to dating sites. Another thing is how nobody thought that fishing could ever happen in the late 90s. It's the same as there was an announcement by Bill Gates a few years ago saying next year there will be no spam. We have it under control. We understand it. It's so easy, whether it's for big thinkers or just average people, to come to the wrong conclusion because of how they feel the world works at that point. But the world changes all the time. If you build a countermeasure, the attackers, driven by economical reasons, will just find another way around it.
Now, if you can look into your crystal ball, can you provide your predictions of future IT business trends and their implications and opportunities?
Well, there's one. I think smartphones, very obviously, are going to become more and more important. We're seeing it today. But the prices are going to be lowered because of competition, to the extent that people are going to think of them as disposable. You know, you could get a new one for $50 maybe with activation, or $30 if you agree to a 2-year contract or something like that. And when that is starting to happen, what is going to happen to security? Well, people are going to think of it in a different way, because what is the worst thing that could happen if they mess up their phone with malware, say? Well, the worst thing is that they get a new phone, and that's it. Imagine a world in which there's a zero cost for getting a new phone. People are going to do absolutely outrageous things when it comes to malware, say, because it's just not their problem. There's no real pain associating with restarting, especially if they can keep their profile synced with their computer or something like that. It's just going to be the same risk as dropping the phone when you're walking on the street. And as a result, you're going to get a new type of crime war out there, and it's going to be very powerful, because it's going to be on the devices that people use for almost any kind of transactions, and devices that know your location. These are, in my vision, of course, all GPS-enabled devices, and they know a lot about you. It's also your phone, of course. It's also your music player. It's such an incredible device for an attacker to corrupt that it just cannot happen. It can't remain secure. And the trends in prices is going to hurt security.
So do you have any additional trends that you want to share with the audience?
Well, as a result of my belief that there will be more crimeware, and of course that they will mutate faster and faster to make it difficult for antivirus filters to block them, there has to be technology that detects bad things that have already happened. Now that might seem trivial, but it's far from trivial. Assume that you are a writer of malware. What would you do? Number one, infect the machine. Number two, cover up the tracks. You wouldn't want it to be known that you corrupted a machine, especially if the main countermeasure is detection of things that have happened and therefore need to be fixed. You'd want to keep it very quiet that the malware is there. And so, as technologists, we need to develop very sure ways of detecting that bad things have happened and allowing to rewind the state in the context of malware that, of course, will do its best to hide its tracks.
Do you have any views on bots?
Bots are tricky. Bots, of course, they're corrupted machines that are used in large numbers, typically, in order to perform some attack, whether it's a denial-of-service attack on a casino or something like that, or whether it's on a bank, or whether they're just used to host phishing pages or send spam. They're difficult to deal with because these are computers of average users, and they're replaceable. It doesn't matter if it's person A or person B who's got his computer taken over. They're in hundreds of thousands out there, and they're just dumb machines from the point of view of the attacker. How can you quarantine or cure bots? Especially in the context if the bot is on, say, a router, a wireless router, where the real purchase cost is, say, $50. It's cheap. You could just go and buy a new one, but why would you? Because it's still working. It still appears to work just fine. Maybe it's just a little bit slower, but you don't know why. why would you do anything to your router when it seems to work just fine? You would not. And so the problem is, how can you, first of all, detect? That's number one, always. Detect that something bad has happened. And then, how could you fix the problem? You can't always just say, this machine is a bot and therefore we can't take any traffic from it, because that's normal user traffic too coming from this machine. You need some way of rewinding the state. And this is not a problem that has been very well addressed by scientists and practitioners.
You know, just sort of extending that trend about bots and curing them and quarantining them and so forth, you know, I just recently bought a television, and it has an Ethernet connection, and I bought a data terminal for my cable service, and guess what? It has an Ethernet connection, and I have a game machine, and it also has an Ethernet connection. All of these, I take it, are susceptible. So what is the consumer to do?
There is not much to do. And of course, as devices get more and more networked, they're all at higher risk. Now it's pretty obvious that a phone will come with Bluetooth. Now new cars also come with Bluetooth. That means, assume that you download a virus onto your phone. It could hop to your car. Well, you could argue that in spite of the fact that it could hop to your car, it can't do much damage, because there are two computer systems on the car, one which is the infotainment system and one which is taking care of the driving of the car and all the critical functions, and they're separated. But your GPS system, that is part of the infotainment system. What if you are told to go to the wrong part of town, or you're told to go on the highway, on the off-ramp of the highway? It has incredible PR effects, of course, to the car manufacturers if their cars start working in an erratic way or even dangerous way. And you could imagine a blackmail attack where somebody spreads a virus by phone that hops to the car and just puts itself there, performs a small number of attacks, and the attacker calls up, say, BMW or Toyota, and say, you know, I think you got a problem, and we know how to fix it, but it, of course, you know, our consulting time is very expensive, and it will cost you maybe $100,000 per day, and we think this might take 10 days to fix, but we'll give you the code to fix it. Now, what can they do? They don't want a PR horror story to hit the New York Times. This is what could happen, and which is not so unlikely. And that's just for cars. There are lots of other consumer devices that very soon will be networked. Cameras is one. You could argue that cameras, again, it doesn't have anything to do with your security, but it sure has to do with your privacy. All of these things that are networked are vulnerable in principle, and it will happen.
You know, Marcus, you've alluded to this before, and that is sort of the whole money aspect. So can you sort of give me your perspectives on trends in terms of the monetization and how that's driving online crime?
You could see it very clearly in the malware development. Take the first virus that existed, 1986. It's the Brain Boot virus. It was written by two Pakistani guys, and what it did was it spread by storage, like a floppy disk or something like that, onto your boot sector, and it displayed a message, and it was gone. That was it. Well, it had your machine, and every disk, of course, that you input would get the boot sector infected, but that was it. There was no monetization, really. Today, it's very, very different. Malware will stay silent, so that you won't know it and you won't remove it. They will try to steal money in various ways. They will monetize their existence on a machine. That has all the trends in online fraud are driven by this fact that things are monetized now. Online crime is not a matter of, well, a couple of college kids sitting together and thinking that this would be so funny and see who gets the virus that spreads the fastest. It's organized crime. And that's, of course, they don't care about intellectual challenge. They want money. And that's what we're seeing. So if we just think money, we just think, how could I get money on the internet by doing things that are not tolerable ethically or security-wise, and you think hard, you will see what are the possible trends. That is what we have to defend against.
You know, Marcus, in your research then, do you have any statistics in terms of where it's heading and, you know, percentages, that kind of thing?
Percentages are very hard to tell. I performed a lot of experiments to assess relative risks and to also to try to understand whether the numbers that are quoted by the organizations like Gartner are correct. And I believe they aren't. For example, in the context of have you been fished, Gartner will say that around 4% of adult Americans in a year will say that they've been fished. Now, I've come to believe that this is not true for two reasons. One is that many people are fished and they don't know it. They don't. Some might not ever know it. Some might not know it until years later. But also, a lot of people are embarrassed. There's a stigma associated with having been taken advantage of. And maybe if I were fished and I feel embarrassed about it, I will not disclose it. And this is happening. And we are looking at much more realistic estimates of the number of people that have been fished by having performed real experiments on people that we could see. Well, this was the success rate of this particular attack. There was one particular experiment that I performed with one of my former students, Jacob Ratkiewicz. We targeted eBay users, and we got an over 10% yield per attack, not per year. That shows that people are much more vulnerable than they thought they were. We used, in another study with several of my colleagues, we looked at what kind of yields can you get if you know who knows whom. So it's a social phishing attack. We got remarkable results. Over 70% of the people targeted fell for it, with a very, very, very low error margin because we targeted a lot of people in this particular study. They're all unaware of being studied, of course, so you got the results that are truthful. And this is the way I believe a lot of the security work has to be done, by experiments, where you say, okay, we cannot trust what people do. We have to first find out what people do.
So you talk about these experiments and then applies to trends. How can we, as IT professionals or business professionals, access some of the research that you're doing? Or the results of the research?
Well, you have to know when to educate users and when not to. So take the example of the first four versus last four that I mentioned before. You could argue that banks are educating people to do something that is risky by doing this. They should probably not do it. They should probably find another way of doing mutual authentication, and there would be alternatives. They should pick things that the implicit education is positive. And then they should have very carefully crafted education to address things that could be changed. For example, people don't understand URLs. That's why people fall for phishing attacks. Custom name attacks are absolutely impossible to understand by a majority of people out there. Knowing this, you could take action. You could have a filter that aims for looking for similar sounding or similar looking URLs. So understanding what the vulnerabilities are, you could either educate people, say, well, it has to say Chase in the early part of the URL right here and not that towards the very end, or it needs to say Bank of America, not bank/of/America, because that's not the same. And then financial institutions need to be very careful when they do advertising. Lots of outsourcing is done today. There's a company called Bigfoot that sends a lot of email from financial institutions. When I get something and I look at the return path, this is not the normal thing for people to do, of course, and it says Bigfoot. Well, if I didn't know that they did it on behalf of many big banks, I would think that this is a phishing attack. You have to make everything make sense at the same time. So everything must fit together, and any kind of education that is performed implicitly or explicitly must be in the right direction to make things more safe, not less safe. And that's difficult.
You know, we talked about a lot of the risks out there and security and so forth, and based on your insights of doing extensive research in this area, you know, what are your top recommended resources and why?
The APWG website, that's the website of the Anti-Phishing Working Group, it's a good update of information. You could see, you could infer trends from it, it's good. McAfee and Symantec, they have newsletters that are great. I would say that those are valuable to go to. Also, it's important with internal resources. Having devious people on staff and let them think, how could I break the system? Or if you don't, if you aren't able to do it, then have consultants who would say, well, my goal is to break the system, now how would I do it? You cannot undervalue public scrutiny of things. If you think you got a good system, well, maybe publishing it is the best thing because people will poke at it. People out there whose tenure opportunities depend on whether they can find flaws with things, they will come to you and say, look, you can't do it in this order, but you need to change to that order. And they will, you know, it will look good for them, and it will be great for you because you will know before the attack starts that, oh, I got to change it. Magazines like IEEE Security and Privacy, they're easy to access. They're very quick to learn Transform. They're great. And, you know, I have to say it, of course, my books. My books are great resources. There are many other books, but I'm really trying to get the technical and the social material easily accessible for the average reader. And understanding these together is a very important thing. Those are the top resources I would mention.
Okay, Marcus, we're at this point in the interview where we're at the end or near the end, and typically I turn it around. If you were doing this interview, what questions would you ask, and then what would be your answers?
Well, maybe the first one would be, what would you do if you were a Fisher? I would look for untraceability, or I would switch to click fraud if I think there's too much of a risk in phishing, because after all, phishing is illegal and click fraud is against the terms of service if you do it right, that's all. So what would you do as a phisher? What are the steps that you would take, collecting information, targeting people? And once you answer that question, well, maybe you should think that this is going to happen, and what would you do to counter that? Here's another one. How about if you wanted to control a bot network? What would you do? Would you go for the router, say? Would you do a social networking attack? Would you set up a site that is perfectly legitimate looking and where people download peer-to-peer software? But the software does one more thing than it claims. It also does surveillance of the machines. Maybe it does other things as well. So how would you craft an attack very cleverly to control a huge bot network, and how would you hang on to it? Here's another topic. What is the greatest mistake the CISO could make? Well, I think to think that the system is secure when there are no more attacks, that's totally wrong. You see it in financial institutions. I have consulted for several large financial institutions, and they would report that one quarter fraud is up and the next quarter fraud is down, and they would come to me and said, you know, we don't have any problems anymore. And I'm saying, maybe you think you have no problems, but that's because somebody else has more problems than you do right now, or maybe because it's summer and fishers too like to go on vacation, and so of course attacks are down. Wait until fall and see. And sure enough, in fall things pick up. Or after another bank that used to be very vulnerable fix their things, well, that bank is still a desirable target. It's just never time to say we've solved the problem. If it seems to work, then start thinking about what's the next thing to worry about. Here's number four. If you represented a large bank, what would you fear most of all? Most of all, what's the worst thing? Is it that people, your clients, would be afraid of banking online? Is it that you would have to pay a huge ransom to somebody? Is it that you would have to rehaul your website every week because you made a mistake before that turned out to be awful and you have to update? Is it that you didn't do the password reset questions right and it turns into a huge deal because you used, say, mother's maiden name as an authenticator, which banks often do, and then the attacker got the mother's maiden name, and it's very hard to switch to the new system, especially when people are all entrenched in the old one. So what would you fear most of all? What is the problem? And that's, of course, the one that's going to cost you the most. That's the one the attacker is very likely to go for. And here's the last one. Does it matter that people use the same passwords at many sites? Well, actually, I would say it doesn't matter so much. In the context of the fact that they do use the same security questions on most sites. If you were a bad website, you wouldn't really care about getting people's passwords if you could get their security questions. Say that you could ask the very same security questions as some major financial banks and PayPal and eBay ask. People would have no choice but to answer them correctly when they want to set up an account on your site. You would know these answers now. It doesn't matter if they use the same password on your site as on those other sites. You know the answers to these questions. That's a big problem, and people just don't seem to realize the importance of fixing that part of it. People talk passwords when they should think authentication in general. What are the ways in which you authenticate to the system? And this authentication has a tremendous cost. If you have a support call, the average cost for a support call to reset a password is $22. Now, there are many organizations that just cannot handle that kind of cost. You have to understand security and the costs of doing this and balance everything.
You know, Marcus, if this was the ideal world, sort of like what would you like to see happen, and what are your personal goals?
Whoa, these are difficult questions. What would I like to see happen? I would like to see an integration of goals in the security departments and the PR departments of large financial institutions. That's one thing. Because right now, they're acting as two different individuals, two different entities. What is good for PR is not always very good for security. And coordination here is important. I wish that there were better coordination inside large institutions. I also wish that more organizations were a little bit humble when it came to security, and they realized that they might not have the best things in sliced bread, and they need to go out and ask people for their opinion and have it publicly reviewed, maybe, or at least scrutinized by a bunch of experts who would say, well, you know, it all looks fine, but for this part, now change that, or you are in so much trouble that you can't believe it. Keeping things secrets is just waiting for bad things to happen. People can reverse engineer, you could have insider attacks, you just cannot leave security as something that relies on the secrecy of your system. Those are big things. I would like to see that change. As for personal goals, you know, I love the kind of research I'm doing. I am trying to understand how security in a holistic manner affects us and how we could improve the security, how we could imagine what the next big wave of problems are and preemptively fix it. That's really what I'm looking to do, and I'm doing it all the time. I have such a blast doing this every day, and I cannot complain.
You know, Marcus, it sounds like your job, your roles, it's like your hobby, too.
It is, yes. It's a nice thing when things coincide like that, to get paid for your hobby, pretty much.
And like you said, when you work at Park, you're given a fair amount of freedom as well. So.
I am. It's a wonderful thing. It's a great working environment, and also I've some limited resources to do consulting on the side when it doesn't interfere with Park business, and that means that I could take on interesting tasks and learn more as I do, because, of course, every opportunity like that is an opportunity to learn as well as to help.
Well, Marcus, it's been a pleasure to talk with you today, and we'll continue to follow your significant contributions on both a national and global level. And we thank you for sharing your time, wisdom, and accumulated deep insights with our audience.
Well, thank you. It's been a great hour.